Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We are podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show whenever you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can subscribe to the show on iTunes. I'd like to welcome T.R. Reid. He's an American foreign correspondent for The Washington Post and author of 9 books. He's currently working on a 10th titled The Healing of America. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks. Delighted to be here.
So The Healing of America is a book based on the reality that the United States is number 37 around the world in healthcare. That's a pretty low ranking for this wealthy country with such great technology and supposedly good healthcare.
Yeah, it's striking, isn't it? We're the richest, most powerful country in history. We lead the world in almost every area of medical research. And yet when it comes to providing health care to our people, as you said, the World Health Organization rated us 37th. We have great health care in America. And, you know, Arab sheiks fly to the Mayo Clinic to get treated. They could go anywhere in the world. But we also leave a lot of people out. According to the National Academy of Sciences, about 20,000 Americans die every year of treatable diseases because they can't afford to see a doctor in the richest country in the world. That really bugs me. I think that's terrible that we let that happen.
What are those diseases, those treatable diseases that people are dying of here? I mean, in other countries, you think of diarrhea and cholera and malaria and things like that.
Well, in poor countries, yeah. No, what happens is Americans get these chronic diseases, diabetes, lupus, et cetera. These are treatable diseases. Modern medicine knows how to give you a life. Lupus strikes mainly women in their 20s. And with the proper medical regime, though 80% of them live a normal lifespan. They live to be 80 years old. Some Americans die of this disease because you got to go to a doctor and you got to take drugs, and that takes money. And the people who tend to die in America because they can't see a doctor are people who have too much money to be on Medicaid and too little money to pay for the drugs. They're kind of the in-between Americans. And I think most Americans don't know this is happening. I think most Americans would say, yeah, anybody in our country who's sick can see a doctor. It's not true. You know how many people die of treatable diseases in Canada? Zero. How many in Britain? Zero. France? Zero. Germany? Zero. Japan? Zero. Other countries don't let it happen. But our country has never made the commitment to provide everybody health care who needs it. And then the other thing is, according to Harvard, about 700,000 Americans go bankrupt every year for medical bills. That doesn't happen in any other country either. And so what I'm doing in this book is I'm going around to other countries like us, rich industrialized democracies, and see how they do it. Somehow, Mary Charlotte, they managed to cover everybody with very good results, usually better healthcare results than we have. And they spend half as much per capita on health care. So how come they get better results and spend less? That's what my book is about. How do you do that?
You made a Frontline documentary last year called Sick Around the World. And I guess your book is probably an expansion of that to some extent. And you went to Germany, Taiwan, Switzerland, Great Britain, and Japan. You looked at how each healthcare system works. First of all, how did you choose that selection of countries?
Well, as I said in my book, I'm looking at countries like us that we could copy from. I'm not looking at Cuba. We'll never do what Cuba has done. I'm not looking at Russia because we'll never be a country like Russia. But I'm looking at industrialized democracies and countries that we could emulate. And the reason we went to those five, I went to 10 countries for the book, but the reason we went to the doctor in those five countries is, well, first of all, my family lived in Britain and Japan, so we use the healthcare system there. I know those pretty well. I know the language in both Britain and Japan, although the Brits speak kind of a weird English. But
you can understand.
Yeah. But basically, there are different models for providing healthcare, and I'm going to discuss this in the speech I'm going to give in Santa Fe in April. We tried to find different examples of the various models of healthcare. So Taiwan uses the Canadian kind of model, and Britain has its own model. Germany has a model of its own, and Japan uses that too, and Switzerland switched to that. So we were looking for countries like us, a couple of countries that I'd lived in and taken my kids to the doctor there, and countries that could be a model for the U.S.?
So Great Britain, one of the things that I think makes it difficult to establish a productive dialogue, at least in sometimes in the media and among politicians, when you start talking about healthcare, is people say Great Britain and then other people say socialized medicine and then the conversation's over.
Exactly. That's absolutely true in America. It's not just Britain. Many Americans think all the other countries are socialized medicine, big government, nanny state kind of medicine. That's absolutely not true. It's just not the case. Some countries do have a system where the government owns the hospitals and provides the medicine and pays for the medicine. I'd call that socialized medicine, and Britain is an example of that. But many other industrialized democracies cover everybody with high-quality care using private docs, private hospitals, and private insurance plans. And they still spend half as much as we do. And that's why I set out to write the book, How You Do That.
So what do they do in Britain? I mean, it's their whole health system is paid through taxation. Is
that
right?
The basic rule in Britain is you should go your whole life and never have a doctor bill. And about 97% of all the people in Britain do live their entire life and never pay a doctor bill or a hospital bill because they view healthcare like a public library, like the fire department. When you need the service, you get it. You don't pay because you pay through taxes. They definitely pay for healthcare in Britain, although they only pay about half as much per capita as we do. But they pay, but they pay through taxes. When we lived there, we lived in London and we moved there. And one of the first things you notice when you live in London is expensive. It's just as expensive as all get out. And then on top of the high prices, they add the sales tax to everything you buy, including food, 17.5%.
Good heavens.
What's the sales tax in New Mexico? 7% or something?
Like that.
Yeah. 8%. So more than double in Britain on everything you buy. And get this, Mary Charlotte, because they're in a recession right now in Britain, they decided to do some tax relief. So for 1 year, temporarily, they cut the sales tax. It's only 15%.
Right.
Anyway, so my wife and I were thinking, whoa, 17.5%. And actually in Europe, that's fairly cheap. In Sweden, it's 25%. But anyway, we were ticked off about this. It's expensive anyway. And then here's what happened. We had been in Britain about 5 days. We hadn't even unpacked the boxes. And one of my kids got a bad infection on her ear, swollen, pus flowing, really bad pain. And we didn't have a doctor. We knew nothing. We didn't know where the hospital was, you know. So we went out and got in one of those big London black cabs. And I said to the cab driver, look at this girl's ear. What do I do? And he took us to a hospital. And we went into the casualty ward. That's what they call the emergency room, the casualty ward. And the nurse came over, figured out which of us was, it was pretty obvious which of us needed a doctor, took her in a room, waited 10 minutes maybe. A doctor came, lanced this swelling, drained the pus. My daughter came out beaming. She felt great, you know, and you can imagine how her parents felt. You know, this daughter had been cured. And I went over to the head nurse. She's called Matron in Britain. I went over to Matron and pulled out my checkbook. So if you took your child to the emergency room in America with a seriously infected ear, what would you pay?
Oh, it's, I mean, that's
400,
the thing.
500 bucks,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, or more. You might pay 1,000.
Fine, and I would have paid that. I mean, they cured my child. I felt great about it. And Matron says to me, oh, no, 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 you may put away your checks. We don't do it that way here.
Yeah.
And we were walking out of this hospital where we got great treatment free. And my wife said to me, now I see why we pay the 17.5%.
Right.
So you do pay. But as a matter of fact, it nets out that Brits pay less than Americans do. And everybody gets treated and they have better health results. So that's the point of my book. How do you do that?
Well, I want to get to that in a moment, the various ways in which these different countries actually save money, because it's not mysterious. It's very clear.
And no, it's
you make
quite
it clear.
Out there. Yeah.
But in Britain, just staying with Great Britain for a moment, they actually have a system of giving doctors bonuses when their patients are healthy.
Yeah, this is kind of the holy grail for healthcare economists all over the world, including the United States. The hot term for this is PFP, pay for performance. Many people feel one of the problems with American healthcare is we pay for procedure. The more work your doctor does for you, the more she gets paid.
So there's actually an incentive to keep people sick on, if you want to think of it that way.
Well, I wouldn't put it that way. It's too nasty, Mary
Charlotte.
Right,
but I mean...
There is an incentive to maybe do more medicine than is required.
Right.
And that adds to the cost. And I think a doctor would probably say, well, I just want to be safe with my patient, so I'm going to give her another x-ray, which is a good thing to do, but they get paid for it. In Britain, the doctor gets paid by the number of patients on her list. And, you know, an average doctor might have 1,600, 1,800 people. She's going to get paid for each one of those, whether they ever come see her or not. So her interest is keep those people healthy so they never come in. She still gets paid for them.
Right.
And then the way pay for performance works is, as I said, all these economists like this, but nobody's figured out how to pay doctors for performance, how to even know if their patients are healthy. And the Brits went to the British Medical Association and said, well, gee, if we were going to pay doctors to keep people healthy, what should we pay for? How would we know? And the doctors snookered them, I think. So the British Medical Association gave them a list of things that doctors should be paid for that keep people healthy. And you know what? It's stuff that all doctors do anyway. You know, give a urine test, you know, ask them if they're sleeping through the night, you know, take their blood pressure. And the doctor that we visited in our film, if I don't know if you noticed, but all his nurses, we were there in November, and all his nurses had a red badge on that said, have you had the flu jab? That means a flu shot, right? He gets $100 for giving each of his nurses one of those red badges, because then more people get a flu shot and they keep people healthy. So the doctors kind of rigged it, and yeah, they make a ton more money just by doing things that they kind of did anyway. And this has now been gradually refined. The National Health Service figured out it had been snookered by the doctors. So now they have a better set of mechanisms for paying. But, you know, if you come into the doctor and have a bad cough or something, she treats you. And then 10 days later, she drops by your house and says, let me hear you cough. You know, how you doing? She gets paid for that.
They drop by your house.
Yeah, doctors come to your house in Britain.
So wow.
What's not to like, right? Your kid gets sick. Your kid has an earache, otitis media. You call the doctor. That afternoon, she's in your house. She says, I think perhaps penicillin. She gives your kid a shot. Kid feels better. The doctor walks out the door, and there's no bill.
Amazing.
That's a system.
That's a healthcare system.
That's one way to design a healthcare system. I liked it a lot. I'm not saying the British system is perfect, as you saw in our film. There are long waiting lines. They're getting shorter, but they have that problem.
And long waiting times for an operation or
for elective surgery. Yeah, you often have to wait. And the facilities, they don't spend money on facilities. They're pretty grody. They're pretty run down. You get good care. But, you know, this hospital where we took our daughter with her ear, swollen ear, they had buckets in the hallway catching the leak from the roof and stuff like that, and could have used a paint job. I don't think it had been painted in 100 years, but
right. Meanwhile,
good care.
Japan and Taiwan are known for having no waiting times at all. You can walk into any doctor's office and get treatment.
Yeah, in Japan, we lived in Japan, and I have a bum shoulder, and it was hurting me pretty badly. And I was just kind of asking around and said, I really need an orthopedic, an orthopedic specialist to look at my shoulder. And, you know, people said to me, it's a hierarchical country. They know who's number one. And they said, well, really, the best orthopedic surgeon in Japan is this Dr. Nakamichi. He's at the famous Keio University Hospital. And, you know, he'd be the best guy you could see. So I call Dr. Nakamichi's office, you know, at 10 o'clock in the morning. It was a Thursday. Could I get an appointment? And the receptionist says, well, yeah, but just come on in. You might have to wait a while. So I go in there and I wait about 20 minutes and I'm in to see Nakamichi, the best orthopedic surgeon in Japan. Yeah, you've got a bad problem there. Let's take some x-rays. You know, I could recommend surgery. You might be a good choice for surgery on this. Well, when could you do it? It's a Thursday, right? And he says, tomorrow's booked up. How about someday next week? So, yeah.
And he's apologizing and you're
happy.
Yeah.
They're incredibly sorry if they make you wait 5 minutes. So, and Taiwan, too. And what happened there is they just have enough doctors and they've put enough money into facilities, into, surgery wards, et cetera, so that people don't wait. And people get very ticked off if they have to wait. Yeah, they've done it differently.
Now, Japan doesn't have the same thing that Great Britain has. They have health insurance. Everybody has to sign up for health insurance, but then if you can't afford it, the government kicks in.
Yeah, that's right. That's a standard model around the world. You get health insurance from your employer. Unlike in America, if you lose your job or leave your job, you don't lose your insurance. The government takes over until you get a new job. If you can't afford insurance, then the government pays the premium and covers it. And everybody has to get insurance. I don't know if you remember, but in last year's election, Obama and Hillary Clinton argued about this mandate that everybody has to get insurance. And one of the questions is, well, how do you enforce it? How do you make people get insurance? They have a really good answer to that in Japan. In Japan, everybody's supposed to have insurance. There's a very small number of people, a tenth of 1% of the population, maybe 100,000 people, don't have health insurance. One of them is a friend of mine, incidentally. He feels like he's a criminal. But the deal is, if you go to the doctor and you're sick, they check to see if your insurance is paid up. And if you haven't paid, first they make you pay all of last year's premiums before you can get treated. So you're kind of taking a big chance, and therefore most people get insurance. The other really interesting mindset that I think is important is in Japan and most of those countries, they feel that buying health insurance is a matter of personal responsibility. And it's absolutely true. Everybody needs to be responsible for preserving her own health. And the only way you can have a healthcare system that covers everybody at an affordable price is if people take care of themselves. They try to eat carefully. They try to exercise. And in those countries, they feel that part of personal responsibility is buying insurance, whether you feel sick or not.
I think one of the kind of snow jobs that's put over on the American people is that the market system is the best system for everything, including healthcare. And I have had the personal experience of trying to compare health insurance policies from different insurance companies. And it's very difficult. So the idea that you can be an informed consumer and go shopping for the right policy, I don't know is it easier in Japan?
Yeah, you get insurance through your employer or through the local government if you're not working. And there's one plan. You don't have a choice. You're getting individual insurance here or through an
employer?
Well,
no, not anymore, but in the past. Yeah. I mean, I think this is a problem that confronts many Americans is that there are not so many full-time employers as there used to be. A lot of people are so-called part-time or contract workers. And they are not even offered insurance. And so when you're in that position, as I have been and as many people are, you have to either have no health insurance or you have to shop around. And shopping around is kind of a nightmare.
Yeah, it's tough. And, of course, in America, the health insurance companies don't want to sell their product to anybody who might actually get sick and file a claim. So
Right. They
have this pre-existing condition business. And it can be pretty harsh. We found a case in California, a guy was turned down for insurance, and he has a right under state law there to find out why. And so he wrote into the insurance company and said, why did you turn me down? When he was in seventh grade, he had jock rash and had gone to the doctor for it. And on that grounds, he had a pre-existing condition and couldn't buy insurance in the United States of America. So no other country lets that happen. In other countries, they have to cover you. But if you had a system where people waited till they got sick and then went to the insurance company and had to be covered, well, the insurance companies would go broke. And so this is why everybody's required to buy insurance. It gives the insurer a big enough pool of people that they can insure people and not go broke. So those two go together, that the insurers have to cover everybody and everybody has to buy the policy. And then the third leg of that stool is in all the other countries in the world, all free market democracies, health insurance is nonprofit. And the reason for that is they've just decided, these countries have decided that there's a fundamental conflict there. If your mission as a corporation is to pay a dividend to your stockholders, well, then you don't want to pay people's medical claims.
Right.
Right. And then you don't want to cover anybody who might get sick and actually cost you money. All the other countries have decided that making a profit and insuring people's health doesn't work. There's a difference in healthcare between providing healthcare, the providers are docs, hospitals, drug companies, the people who give you care, and paying for care. That's the insurance system. most of the other countries have decided that the providers, doctors, hospitals, labs, they can be for profit. That works fine. But they've all decided that the payment system has to be nonprofit. The United States is the only country where health insurers are allowed to make a profit. And guess what? We have the highest administrative costs of any payment system in the world. Don't you think that for-profit free enterprise is efficient by nature? That's what I think. But in health insurance, as a matter of fact, the American health insurance companies, their administrative costs and their profits add 20 to 25% to every doctor bill. And they're private companies. You go to Canada, where the health insurance is all government, you know, lazy government bureaucrats, their administrative costs are 5%, one-fifth as much. In France, it's 3%. So, yeah, it's striking to me. I thought free market, free enterprise, competitive free enterprise would do everything more efficiently, but it doesn't seem to work in health insurance.
Now, another dimension to all of this is that in Japan and in other places, too, there are mechanisms by which the price of healthcare and the price of pharmaceuticals is controlled. And because of these controls, I mean, I was really struck by the fact that in Japan, an MRI costs less than $100.
Is that amazing? Yeah. That's what I'm getting at there when I said they cover everybody, they have a high quality of care, and they spend a lot less. Different countries have different mechanisms for this, but I, you know, I'm a brilliant reporter, right? I lived in Japan and I figured out the secret of how Japan provides health care for everybody with very good health statistics, better than ours, and spends half as much. You know how? They shaft the doctors and they shaft the hospitals. They have a really stingy payment scale. And there are, it's not a single payer system. They have 3,500 insurance plans in Japan, but it's a unified system, is a coordinated system of payment. One thing about this is it's vastly simpler. A doctor only has to have one form in the office.
Right.
You know, an American doctor has 70 or 80 different forms and rules. And so it's vastly simpler and cheaper in that regard. But if you have one payment system, that's the only place the doctor can sell her service, right? So guess what? The payer gets to set the price. They negotiate every 2 years in Japan with the doctor's union, but all the power, all the negotiating power is on the side of the payer, of the health ministry.
And yeah, the health ministry represents the people, essentially.
Yeah, that's what they do. So as you saw in our film, last year I had an MRI on my neck in Denver. I live in Denver, and it was $1,234. And when we were in Japan, I saw the doctor we were with had a pretty close to the same MRI machine. And I said, gee, how much would you charge me for my neck here, you know, doing an MRI on my neck? And he opens his payment scale. It's issued to him. You know, it's like a telephone book. Let's see. That would be 9,800 yen, $98. So I then said to the health minister, as you saw in our film, I don't understand this. It's a $1,200 procedure. Why would a doctor do it for $98? And the minister says, you seem to forget he has no other place to sell his service if he wants to. So that raises the question, how can doctors afford this? How can you give a $1,200 procedure for $98 and still feed your family, right? And I think there's a totally fascinating result from this. In America, the healthcare industry says, well, gee, if you cut our prices, you would cut innovation. And we wouldn't be able to invent all these great new devices that keep people alive. In Japan, where they have these very strict price controls, the doctors went to the makers of MRI machines or MRI scanners, and two of the biggest in the world are Toshiba and Hitachi, Japanese companies. And they said, we can't pay $450,000 for this MRI machine. That's what GE charges, what most
right.
people charge, because we'll never make our money back at $98 a scan. And so they pressured Toshiba and Hitachi to make much cheaper, simpler MRI machines without all the bells and whistles on the GE machine. They cost about $75,000, less than a fifth of what American doctors pay. If you have that machine, then you can give an MRI for $98. And get this, now those Japanese makers are exporting their cheaper MRI scanners all over the world. It's
right.
been a huge boon for Japan. So this is the opposite of what we hear in America. We gotta charge high prices to generate innovation. In Japan, it was the pressure from above to keep the price down that generated the innovation.
We're talking to author and journalist T.R. Reid. His upcoming book is called The Healing of America. I think it's important to talk about in the United States, apropos of what you were just saying, who's getting rich and who isn't. So when you graduate from college and you decide to go to professional school, some people become teachers and some people become doctors. And doctors make, what, 5, 10, 15 times, 20 times as much as teachers, depending on their specialty here in the United States.
Yeah.
In Japan and in Germany, doctors at this point are not getting rich. They're living good lives. They're probably making more than people in other kinds of service jobs. But they are not wealthy people with great big cars and estates and multiple houses and all that kind of thing.
They don't drive a Lexus to the country club. That's exactly right. The doctor whom we spent some time with in Tokyo makes about as much as a mid-level executive his age at Toyota would make. A mid-level insurance company executive or government employee. Teachers do very well in Japan. You know, those Confucian societies really honor teachers. So teachers get very well paid in Japan, about the same as a doctor. But no, these are not really rich people in other countries. But, you know, I know a lot of doctors, American doctors. Most doctors got into this because they kind of like science and they want to help people. And yeah, of course, everybody would like to make more money, but that's not their driving motivation. We produce a breed of doctors in America who start off with a $200,000 debt from medical school, so money does become important to them. We have very, very high malpractice premiums, vastly higher than any other country. So we kind of force doctors to worry about these economic situation. These are problems that doctors overseas don't get.
For example, as you point out in the documentary, in Germany, they pay $0 for their medical education. So they come out of medical school debt-free. It's vastly different.
Yeah, that's true all over Europe. That's true and basically true in Japan, too. And then their expectation is different. They don't expect to make $450 a year. Are they satisfied? You know, Mary Charlotte, I've been a foreign correspondent, and I've always found everywhere in the world farmers don't make enough money. I've never met a farmer who's paid enough for the work he does, and same for doctors. It's very rare to meet a doctor who says, yeah, I make enough. I'm certain that's true for newspaper reporters. We're all underpaid. There's no question about that. But basically, doctors overseas make a lot less than Americans do, and they're just as happy. They're serving people. And in many ways, they're happier because they're working in a system that provides care to everybody.
The inequality of our system is something that each of these other countries has really tried to address. And one of the things that was so striking was that both Germany and Switzerland really took on healthcare reform and made some big changes. Switzerland did it, I guess, in the 90s, and it was a very close vote, but they mandated that everybody buy insurance and, you know, the government buy insurance for the poor and so on. And now they have this model, which when it was voted on in referendum, half the people in the country were ambivalent about. Now everybody, conservative and liberal, is into it.
Exactly right. The fundamental difference in Switzerland was until the mid-90s, they had a system like ours where the health insurance companies were for-profit. And if you're a for-profit company, as we said earlier, one thing you don't want to do is cover anybody who's sick. You know, that could cost you money. And they got to the point where the insurance companies were turning people down in Switzerland because of pre-existing condition. And guess what, Mary Charlotte? This will shock you. Fasten your seatbelt. They got to the point where 5% of the people in Switzerland couldn't buy health insurance. Now, the United States is at 17% today, right? But 5% was totally unacceptable. So they revamped the system, and one of the most important changes they made was the health insurance companies couldn't make a profit anymore. They exist now to pay people's bills, not to make a profit. The insurance companies fought that like crazy. They had a national referendum. That's how they do things in Switzerland. And the bill barely passed, as you said. That was 10 years ago. And now everybody likes it. And in our film, we talked to the president. The thing about Switzerland, Mary Charlotte, is, you know, it's a country of 8 million. And we came there and said, we're making a movie for American PBS public broadcasting. And, you know, in Europe, the public broadcaster is the big broadcaster. It's bigger than NBC or CBS. So if you come there and say, we're from public broadcasting in America. Whoa, you must be important, you know. So we went to Switzerland, and in most countries, we went there and said, could we speak to your health minister? We went to Switzerland, and they said, well, why don't you interview our president?
Oh, my goodness.
And then they said, and, you know, why don't you interview last year's president, because she's now the health minister. So we talked to two presidents of Switzerland. But the guy that you saw interviewed is a Republican. He's a businessman from the pro-business conservative party. And he originally opposed this plan to take the profit out of insurance. And I said, how's it working? He said, oh, we'll never go back. This is vastly better because now we have everybody covered. And it's very, very important in our society that we treat everybody equally on certain things. And, you know, the things you listed, everybody gets one vote. Everybody gets a free education. Everybody has access to a reasonably priced rail ticket because everybody in Switzerland travels by train. That's a human right there. And everybody who needs it has access to a doctor at a reasonable price. And we had this terrible situation in Switzerland. 5% of our people couldn't go to the doctor. How could any country live that way? And I'm sitting there thinking, well, we're at 17% and we're doing it.
So when we look at healthcare reform in the United States, we have all of these models, Germany, Switzerland, Japan, Great Britain, and actually Taiwan is an interesting example that you give because they became a wealthy country very rapidly, and they just decided that they were going to take the best of everybody else's system, put them together into their system, and they have an extraordinary situation where they have the lowest administrative costs in the world, 2%.
Right, yeah.
No denied claims. They've got a working system that they constructed from the ground up.
Yeah, I would say they pretty much took the Canadian system. I'm going to describe this in this talk I'm going to give in Santa Fe. But they looked around the world and were looking for a healthcare system. And as you saw in the film, the guy who was in charge of this search did come to America and look at the American system. And I said, why didn't you copy us, you know? He said, oh, no.
And he politely said, no, thank you.
Yeah, exactly. He was being polite about it. Not a chance, he said. Isn't your country the one that leaves 47 million people without coverage? Well, yeah, but yeah, no, they didn't want that. The system they took was the Canadian system, and the basics of that are the people who provide health care, doctors, hospitals, labs, are private businesses, but the payment is all government. This is exactly what happens in Canada. And it's really worked well in Taiwan, and the reason was when they instituted this in the mid-90s, they had about 45% of their country had no insurance, you know, and couldn't go to the doctor. So all of a sudden, with the government covering everybody, they had huge demand. I mean, everybody could now go to the doctor. And so supply provides where demand is there, the supply. So they opened all these new hospitals and clinics. Lots of doctors came from the mainland of China. And so they have a plethora. They have enough doctors now that the doctors are quite competitive. You can always get in. The prices are pretty low. And, yeah, as you say, the administrative costs. The government always said we're going to keep administrative costs to 2%. You remember in American health insurance, the administrative costs are 25%.
Right.
1 year in Taiwan, the administrative costs went to about 2.4%. And the opposition party trashed the government for wasting money.
Right.
Yeah.
So when we look at healthcare reform here and we hear people in presidential elections and in local elections talking about or in congressional talking about healthcare reform, are people like Hillary Clinton and Obama and all these others, are they looking at other countries and how they do it?
No, I don't think when they were talking about healthcare in the 2008 election, they didn't look at these foreign models. And I think one reason is this mindset in America that if you go overseas, it must be socialized medicine. At one point in the Republican presidential primaries, Rudy Giuliani said, well, you know, government-run medicine like they have in Britain where government owns the hospitals and government employs the doctors, that's un-American. Well, I just want to point out that the healthcare system the United States of America has for veterans and for Native Americans is exactly like the British system. The government owns the hospitals and employs the doctors. So If it's on Americans, how come we provide it to our America's military heroes? I've never figured that one out myself.
Well, also, un-American is just such a 1950s kind of McCarthy-era term that doesn't even mean anything. It's just used to arouse.
Do you know where the term socialized medicine came from? Well, in 1947, Harry Truman proposed a healthcare system to cover everybody. And the American Medical Association, the doctors were afraid that then government would dictate what they did and that they wouldn't be able to treat their patients independently because government would be in charge. And so they launched this huge campaign against it, and they hired a PR firm in Chicago. And the PR firm said, well, you know, Harry Truman's healthcare plan would be socialized medicine. Nobody knew what that term meant, but it sounded like the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics. And this is right at the worst part of the Cold War. So the idea was, if you wanted to provide health care for your neighbor when he's sick, you're a communist.
Right.
Right. And that has been an incredibly powerful term in American political jargon, socialized medicine. Even though I ask people when I give talks, somebody define it. Nobody really knows what it means. Well, government's going to treat my hangnail, you know, like that, that people don't really know. But it's a bad term in America. And that's one of the reasons people don't look overseas. And the key finding, one of the key findings of my new book is, no, it's not all socialized medicine. As I said, lots of countries cover everybody with private docs, private hospitals, and private insurance. If I could just point out, I think Germany is less socialized than the United States because in the U.S., when people turn 65, everybody goes to government, almost everybody goes to government health insurance, Medicare. In Germany, you stay with your private insurer all the way, cradle to grave. To me, that's less socialized than America.
But the big difference is health insurance companies being not-for-profit.
That's a huge difference. It's not the only difference, but that's a very important difference.
And another huge difference being prices of medicine and procedures are negotiated, and they're negotiated on a regular basis, and they're controlled. Another situation that I wanted to ask you about, I don't think you – maybe you go into it more in the book than in – which isn't out yet, but than in the documentary. But this question of very high malpractice insurance premiums, how do other countries – handle malpractice and lawsuits and that whole problem?
Yeah, that's an important question, Mary Charlotte. Look, every country needs some mechanism for protecting patients from doctors' mistakes, and particularly if the doctor is just lazy or negligent. I mean, a doctor can make an accidental mistake, and that can really hurt a patient. Maybe you don't want to discipline the doctor for something she didn't mean to do anyway, but you've got to take care of that patient. And some doctors are just negligent and screw up, and maybe that doctor should lose her license or be disciplined. Every system has a mechanism for doing that, but nobody does it through the tort law system like we do because ours is the most expensive, and it really doesn't provide too much for patients. So in other countries, they don't have to buy – some of them have malpractice insurance just in case, but they don't get sued and they don't worry about that.
How do they handle it?
Well, for example – they have a public arbitration system. If you say, well, the doctor screwed up in the delivery and therefore my child has a mental disability because the delivery was screwed up, they go to some board and the board studies it. They go to some board screwed up the delivery was screwed up. They go to some board and the delivery was screwed up. They go to some board and the board studies it, and if they deliver arbitration system,
how do they handle it?
Well, for example, they have a public arbitration system. If you say, well, the doctor screwed up in the delivery and therefore my child has a mental disability because the delivery was screwed up, they go to some board and the board studies it. And if they agree on that, first of all, they come up with recompense for you to make sure that you and your child get the treatment you need. And then they consider whether to discipline the doctor. In Germany, they have an interesting system. Some doctor in your field, you know, dermatologist, radiology, whatever the heck it is, from a different region of Germany comes and spends a week in your office. And that visiting doctor has the right to watch you with patients and review all your patient records. And if she finds that you screwed up or if there's a letter of complaint, then the examining doctor will question you about it and say what? And then writes a report to the Doctors Association or the health ministry and says, well, Dr. Kaufman is messing up here. Dr. Kaufman is messing up here and should lose her license or something. And then they come up with recompense for patients. But I'll tell you a really important difference. In America, the reason we have these $10 million malpractice judgments, a lot of it is these judgments always include health care for life. You know, somebody's been badly hurt. And that is really expensive in America. In Britain, of course, health care for life would be zero. It's right. Free. In France, it would be very, very cheap. In Japan, it would be cheap. So even if you have to reward a patient who was injured by a doctor, it's vastly cheaper because the system is cheaper.
We're talking to journalist and author T.R. Reid. His forthcoming book is called The Healing of America. So what do you hope to accomplish with your book? Obviously, it's very educational for me, for the listeners to KSFR, to hear about this, to hear how they do it in other countries. Most of us don't have the privilege of living abroad and seeing what the healthcare systems are like in other places. And so we don't even have a feel for it. We don't know what to compare it to. But I imagine that it would be your and our fervent hope that politicians start reading your book.
Yeah, here's what I hope to accomplish. I think we are the richest, most powerful, freest nation in the world. We're the most innovative, best educated. We lead the world in so many areas.
Freest?
Yeah. Can you think of a country that's freer than the United States?
Oh, yeah. But anyway, well, that's another conversation.
That's a different topic. And yet, in this very important area of human endeavor, keeping people healthy, we're fourth rate. And I think we ought to fix that. You know, I've lived overseas. I'm a foreign correspondent. And I've always thought that one way to fix the problems, it doesn't matter whether it's a company, a college, a country. If you have a problem, face up to it, try to fix it. And one way to fix it is to see how other companies and other colleges and other countries dealt with it. The fact is, all the other industrialized democracies, countries like us, face the same healthcare problems that we do. They've all come up with better solutions. They all have managed to treat everybody with good quality results for much less money. So why wouldn't we want to look at them and find out how to do it? And I'll tell you one reason why. Because when you say this stuff, you're un-American. Now, I wrote a book. Can I shamelessly plug this other
Please
book?
Do.
Confucius Lives Next Door is the name of this book. The point of that book is if you go to East Asia, those countries have 1/100th the murder rate of the United States. They have very, very low crime rates. They have very low rates of divorce. 1% of the babies are born to single mothers. It's about 33% here. Socially, they're more they're successful countries. And why is that? Well, it's not because they're police states. In fact, most of those countries, Japan has 1/100th the number of jail cells in the United States and 1/100th the crime rate. So how do you get there? So I wrote a book about this. And the basic argument is we're a great country, a wonderful country, the United States, but we'd be an even better country if we had a crime rate as low as Japan's. That's the argument. And, you know, you go on radio shows to sell your book. That's what you do. And they say, well, you hate our country. You know, if it's so great, why don't you go live in Nagoya if it's so great over there? You hear this argument.
But that's such an old-fashioned rhetoric. It's like a 50s and 60s thing. Are they still saying that?
Oh, yeah. You hear this all the time. So in my new book, where I say we could learn how to run a universal health care system for everybody at reasonable cost overseas, I've tried to vaccinate myself against that
attitude.
Criticism. And would you like to know my vaccine?
Yes.
Here's my gimmick. You can tell me whether you think this will work. So because I know that argument's going to come up, you hate our country. How dare you say that the French do something better than we do, you know? I'm dedicating my book to Dwight D. Eisenhower. And the reason is, as you know, I'll just say this for the benefit of the younger listeners, Ike was the supreme commander in World War II in the defeat of Hitler, and then he became president of the United States. While he was fighting the Germans in 1944 and 1945, when our troops got to the German border moving towards Berlin to conquer Germany, lo and behold, they found this amazing thing that nobody knew was there, the best highways in the world. They found this network of four-lane divided highways with no stoplight between the French border and Berlin. All interchanges were overpasses. They had these curving off-ramps and on-ramps so you could get on and off without having to go to a stop sign. Every 100 miles, they had a gas station right on the highway, so you didn't have to leave the highway. Amazing. Nobody. This is called the Autobahns. The Germans built them in the 30s, right? And then Eisenhower becomes president in 1953, and the biggest domestic issue facing America was our domestic transportation network was a mess. And there was a plan to build two-lane highways coast to coast, and they went right through the main street of every city. That was the existing plan. And Ike Eisenhower wrote in his memoir, this was a perfectly legitimate plan, but I had seen the best highways in the world. And I could see in my mind a network of four-lane divided highways with no stoplight from Washington to Los Angeles because I had seen these in Germany. So he took the interstate highway system from the Nazis. He borrowed this idea from the Nazis, and everybody loves the interstate highway system, right? And nobody seems to care that we borrowed it from our enemy. So that's my argument. Even Eisenhower, great American military hero, was willing to borrow ideas overseas, so why don't we do it on healthcare?
We're talking to author and journalist T.R. Reid. How do they raise money for public radio in other countries? We've heard all about how they do healthcare in other countries.
Yeah, you know, Mary Charlotte, I'm a big public radio listener, and I hate it when they say we're going to temporarily interrupt this program and plead for money from you guys, so send in a check. But you know what? It's even worse in other countries. I mean, we're getting off easy in the United States. So we lived in Japan, and NHK is the public broadcaster, is the biggest broadcaster in Japan. It has four TV stations and I think seven radio stations now. And here's what happens. Once a year, a guy comes and knocks on your door and says, by the way, you owe $200 for your annual NHK fee, but it's voluntary.
Oh, right? My goodness.
And $200, well, gee, you know. And if you give him the $200, he puts a sticker on your door that says, this person is a good citizen who has helped all of us by supporting NHK. And if you don't have the sticker on the door, then when your friends come along, you know, it's a shame-based society. They say, oh, you're not helping out. Do you ever listen to NHK? Well, of course, everybody does, you know. Oh, so you're a freeloader. That's pretty nasty. I might be better to have them just come on the radio and say, send a check, you know. And then in Britain, this is really amazing. In Britain, anytime you buy a radio or TV, there's a $100 tax attached, which goes to the BBC, which is their public broadcaster.
Whom we love.
Yeah, BBC's on KSFR. The Beeb is so rich, you know, their budget is over $2 billion a year because of this. But if you didn't happen to buy a TV or radio this year, you still owe. You still owe. And BBC is not run by the government. It's a separate corporation. But, yeah, they say you owe us $100 a year. I think it's £100, which is now about $150 a year. And their theory is everybody either watches or listens to the BBC. There are commercial stations, but it's pretty hard to live in Britain and not watch the Beeb, you know. So here's what they do. Are you ready for this? If you don't pay, if you don't send in the check, then you're liable to a fine. And the first year's fine is $1,000. If they nail you 2 years, it's $10,000 for not paying. And the argument against this is, well, I never listened to the Beeb, so I don't have to pay. If you've never listened, if you don't have a radio or TV, you're fine, right? And if you do have a TV and you can say, I only listen to the sports station or Sky, that's Rupert Murdoch's station, if you could convince anybody, then you wouldn't have to pay. But when they charge people the fine, nobody has ever been able to convince a jury in Britain that they don't watch the Beeb because everybody does. And then get this. Are you ready for this? They're even more ruthless. So they have these trucks with a rotating antenna on top, and they go out to a neighborhood and go around and see which houses are receiving the BBC signal at that frequency.
So they can tell.
Yeah, so they can tell. And then they check, has number 37 Primrose Lane paid its annual tax? And if you don't, they charge you $1,000. So, ladies and gentlemen, may I just say, when KSFR says, please send us a check to help out, you're getting off easy. Send them the check.
Amazing.
Yeah, that's how it works over there. I live in Colorado. I married a Denver native, and Colorado Public Radio is a very good station. it doesn't have as much local content, locally generated content, as this station right here in Santa Fe. I'm quite impressed at the effort, how ambitious KSFR is in producing all this local station like your program, Mary Charlotte. And Colorado Public Radio, just like here, four times a year, I don't know how often you do it, you know, they say, sorry to interrupt the programming you love, but please send a check. And then they talk and gab and blah, blah, you know, like that. And everybody hates it. But as I say, I send them the check because I'm a listener and I just feel I ought to do it.
And we do it only twice a year.
Is that right? Yeah. Really? So see,
you're getting off easy, getting off ladies easy. And gentlemen.
Yeah. Send in the check. Do you happen to have a truck with a rotating antenna to spot people who are listening and not paying?
You know, we just haven't quite put that in our budget yet.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. You better send in the check, people, or they're going to come after you.
T.R. Reid is an American foreign correspondent for The Washington Post. He's the author of 9 books, and his upcoming book is called The Healing of America. Thank you so much for being with us on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Mary Charlotte, it was great. Thank you.
You've been listening.